Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, September 18th, friends, come on in. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
The promise was, you can have it all. But this year, hundreds of thousands of women, especially moms of little ones, are deciding either they can't have it all or they don't want it. The numbers show the sharpest drop in mothers of young children in four decades. Is this a power move or is it a pressure point? Is the high cost of childcare the problem, or are the back to office mandates and stress of juggling it all killing women's ambitions? And what about Black women? You've probably seen the headlines. 300,000 Black women have lost their jobs in 2025. So what's going on? We have a packed show today to help us figure it all out. We have Corinne Lowe, a Wharton professor and author of Having It All, What Data Tells Us About Women's Lives and Getting the Most Out of Yours, all hour on the show. We also have two additional guests that are going to join us as well, and we hope you will participate in the conversation. Our question of the day is, why do you think women, especially mothers, are leaving the workforce? Do you find it hard to balance work and family? Tell us about it. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, please share this video and leave your comment in the chat.
It's also Thursday, so we're asking for your DJ of the Day submissions. We like to end the week with a song picked by one of you on the topic of that day's show. So we just said what the topic is. Send your suggestions to EP Kevin at studio2@whyy.org before 12:30 for a chance to be today's DJ of the day.
Yeah, and the themes, you can think motherhood, working, and please do not pick 9 to 5, working 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton, y'all. Think outside the box. You know, there's so
you
many things.
You can pick it if you don't want to be picked.
Yeah, but that won't be it. But there's other songs, motherhood, working, leaving work, all sorts of things.
Let's get into our trio of local news stories now. Starting with a story that we've all been following since yesterday. Three police officers are dead, two others wounded after a shooting yesterday in a rural part of southern York County in Pennsylvania. This area is about 115 miles west of us near the Maryland border. We're still learning details about what exactly happened here. Officials say this was all related to a domestic incident. Police were there to serve a warrant when they were ambushed. The suspected shooter was shot and killed by police, according to authorities. A source told the Associated Press today that the gunman was a 24-year-old male from this same area of southern York County. That's what we know so far. We expect to learn a lot more in the coming hours.
Yeah, and when I saw the video and photos of the area, there were literally cornfields, and it has really rocked the community there in York County. Governor Shapiro has said this is yet another reminder of the sacrifice of our law enforcement and first responders, and he has ordered all U.S. and state flags on public buildings across the Commonwealth to be lowered to half staff. My heart goes out to the families impacted.
Story number two, Cherry.
Philadelphia International Airport announced plans to spend $500 million on much-needed airport upgrades, all ahead of the big events in the works for 2026. The upgrades will be spread across 50 different projects, and it includes new exits for some of the terminals, bathroom renovations, revamped waiting rooms, new signage, new carpet, new seating. If you've been in Philly International, you probably thought, goodness, we do need some work, okay? And that is going to happen. The airport even has a new logo. There's a slogan that says, quote, good things start here. So you'll start seeing new marketing around that.
Good things start here.
You like that logo? I mean, that slogan there?
It's not really a like or a dislike. I just don't quite get it. It doesn't feel airporty to me.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. And we'll see how they work.
Like, I would expect, like, we're flying to the future, or, you know, something like that. Some sort of play on words that has to do with aviation. Good things start here.
I guess you'll see that.
I'll have to see the logo. I'll have to see it all together. I don't see the vision yet.
Well, they're working on it. By the way, the airport is 85 years old. And so, you know, started to show its age, says the CEO, Atif Saeed. By the way, all eyes will be on Philadelphia. So we'll get a lot of folks coming through PHL, you know, in 2026. I was like, wow, we have World Cup matches. the nation's 250th anniversary, MLB All-Star Game, PGA Championship. Like, there's going to be a lot of folks coming in and out of that airport. By the way, a lot of these projects are already underway, and most are expected to be completed by the end of the year. So if you're flying out for the holidays, you may notice the upgrades.
Yeah, I welcome the upgrades. I have a very low bar here. I expect to have a miserable time at the airport, however it's designed.
The bathrooms will be nice, though. You go in there and be like, oh.
Yeah, like a good bathroom. I just don't want to sit on the floor. However we can prevent that scenario from happening.
Some
I don't
carpets.
Want to have to... Well, I don't want to sit on the floor.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to sit on the carpet.
On the new carpet? I'm just joking.
No.
You're like, no, I need a seat.
I just want a seat, man. That's all I want at the airport.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, like a couple food options.
Yeah.
I don't need anything more than that.
Yeah.
Story number three. This one caught my eye. This is pretty interesting. Okay. Philadelphia Eagles running back Saquon Barkley is among the NFL stars participating in a controversial flag football tournament taking place next spring in Saudi Arabia.
Oh.
Barkley will be joined by many other NFL stars, even Tom Brady, who is pseudo coming out of retirement to play in this flag football tournament. Critics say this is the latest example of Saudi Arabia's efforts to soften its image through sports and perhaps paper over its human rights abuses. The folks involved in this flag football competition have also made big investments in golf, women's tennis, international soccer, and more. And there's another local connection here. The competition is being co-sponsored by the apparel company Fanatics, whose CEO is local businessman Michael Rubin. So this tiptoe of the NFL or football as a product into Saudi Arabia with lots of money behind it, something I'm keeping my eye on.
Yeah, interesting. People call it sports washing.
Yep.
When countries try to use sports to shift their global image. And I know all of the folks involved are probably getting some serious, serious dollar bills.
Yeah, no disclosures, but I'm guessing it's not a small check.
But you know what I will say is I love the idea of keeping our sports legends on the field in some way or competing in some way. Some countries in Asia have found a way to do that. In Japan, they have a show called Final Draft where former top pro athletes compete for money. Korea, they also have the physical 100 where people compete. You get to see all your favorite retired athletes compete. And I'm like, we don't do anything with our retired athletes. And I'm like, I know they're just spending their money, but you wouldn't mind seeing them doing something like playing flag football or something, you know?
No, that doesn't do it for me.
That doesn't do it for you?
I don't care. I think flag football, by the way, is going to be an Olympic sport.
Yeah.
There's definitely some people out there who think this could be a way to introduce football to different audiences.
And then women can play too.
Football for me doesn't do it.
You want to see the
very well. I don't. It's not like I crave violence, but it just does. It's a very like it's just appealing. It doesn't. It's not a very visually appealing game, and it always looks like they're not really trying that hard.
Yeah.
So I don't care.
Because they don't get hurt.
I don't have a special
just grab
desire
the little flag.
To see Tom Brady play more football. He played a lot of football.
He did.
Got to see a lot of it. Don't care. But I am interested in the sports washing angle, and there's been a move from some of these oil-rich companies in the Middle East to try to get their hands into American sports, and this is one of those efforts. So shifting topics coming up, we're going to talk about women leaving the workforce, especially young mothers. We're going to explore why and the consequences. That's all coming up on Studio 2. Do not go anywhere. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The Federal Reserve slashed its benchmark interest rate this week, citing concern about a weakening jobs market. And there's especially troubling signs around the job prospects of women. So far this year, 400,000 women have left the labor market. That's according to an analysis by the University of Kansas.
Drill down further and you'll see a dramatic drop in workforce participation among the mothers of young children. This is a 180-degree reversal from the early pandemic when this same group led the economic recovery. So what's happening? How concerned should we be? And what are the possible policy fixes?
And we'll talk about it with our first two guests. We have Corinne Lowe, professor of business economics and public policy at University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School and author of Having It All, What Data Tells Us About Women's Lives and getting the most out of yours. Corinne, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Julie Cashin, Director of Women's Economic Justice and a Senior Fellow at the Century Foundation. Julie, so nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And for all of you listening at home and elsewhere, why do you think mothers are leaving the workforce? Do you find it hard to balance work and family? Tell us about it. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, Corinne, and then, of course, you as well, Julie, I want to peel back the data a bit, and I want you to break down the numbers and tell me what stands out to you and what makes this moment unusual. Corinne, we'll start with you.
Yeah, so I think what the data is showing us is what I have been hearing from so many women in so many different walks of life, is that things are not adding up for us right now. It's not adding up in a 24-hour day. And I see that in my own research, where I actually study time use data from something called the American Time Use Survey. And what we see is that gender roles have converged in the workplace, but they haven't converged at home. So women are playing the same role in the market as men, and careers are becoming ever more demanding. But men's housework time is pretty much constant since the 1970s. And then starting in the 1990s, you have an explosion in childcare time. We spend twice as much time with our children today as parents a generation ago. Every parent who's listening can picture that extended bedtime routine where you're reading books and you're processing socio-emotional skills. And, you know, I grew up in the 1980s. My bedtime routine was go to bed.
Go to bed, yeah. And so that the time is just not adding up, and that's what's standing out right now. And Julie, your comments, your thoughts, peel back the data, and then tell me what stands out to you and what makes this moment unusual.
I completely agree with Corinne, and I'll add to that that there are two major things. One is our public policies, our workplace policies have actually never been built for caregivers, and in particular, never been built for moms. And so we have long been struggling with this. What's different right now is that in the height of the pandemic, things started to change. We put in more money to the childcare system than we've ever put in before. And that gave childcare providers the opportunity to really have stable childcare in the way that we've always known was needed. At the same time, a lot of individuals were able to work from home. That flexibility, just everything from not having a commute to not necessarily needing childcare at the moment, really made a big difference. And so we had these trends and these public policies at that moment, and that funding for childcare has gone away now. And so most states no longer have that funding. And that means that childcare providers are really struggling. They're having to raise their prices. We've seen childcare prices rise by 30% since 2020, which is more than inflation has risen. So families are really struggling to afford childcare. Return to office policies are meaning that it's harder to have that time that Corinne talks about. And that is all kind of adding up to this being a tough moment.
Yeah. So, yeah, you wanted to add something there, Corinne. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I want to connect childcare prices to those trends that I talked about, where why has parental time increased so much? The reason it's increased so much is because of the science of child development, where we understand now that holding our newborns and, you know, speaking 10,000 words a day to them and, you know, playing enriching toys with our toddlers, that that's crucial to child development. Well, what that did is it actually also changed childcare standards. So in the 1980s, it was perfectly acceptable to have 20, 30 infants with a single caregiver, everyone's in a crib with a bottle, right? Because we didn't actually understand that holding them and talking to them was crucial to child development. You fast forward to today, most states have 4-to-1 infant to child care provider ratios that are required by state law. And that is much more expensive. And so that is one of the reasons why the cost of child care has outpaced inflation so dramatically.
Wow, you need a lot, many, many more child care workers. Yeah.
From what you were describing, Julie, it seems like we got this little almost glimpse, like a peek behind the curtain of a different world, where if the nature of work was radically different, if there were different government policies, we would see a different labor market. And then basically the curtain was put back in place and that world went away. Is that basically what happened, Julie?
That is exactly what happened. And it's actually not the first time that that's happened. During World War II, because men were off fighting the war and they needed women to go work in the factories to build the weapons, they actually, the United States created universal childcare and it really worked. But they took it away when the war ended because they wanted women to go back home and take care of kids, and they wanted men to be able to take those jobs. So we know it can work, and it has worked. And right now we're in this cultural moment where there seems to be a real effort to get women out of the workplace, to, you know, have women at home, barefoot, pregnant in the kitchen. And I, for one, am not on board with this idea of going backwards.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to bring in a caller. We have Lisa from Philadelphia on the line. Lisa, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
A lot of this is just really ringing true for me. I returned from maternity leave earlier this year, and at the same time, my husband was asked to return to the office. So we enrolled our daughter in daycare, and I recently announced my intention to resign from my position in order to go and stay home with her full time. And a lot of the reasons that were cited are really true for me as well. So we find that we just don't have the time in the day to get everything done that we need to, you know, while maintaining adequate sleep and the rising cost of childcare. So all these were kind of reasons that that led us to make the decision.
And Lisa, quick follow-up question. How have you felt about making this decision? Because, you know, a lot of women find it is a tough decision for them, even though it's the right decision. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was definitely a difficult decision to make. Before we decided to make this decision, I did shop around in the workforce to see if there are other positions out there that might have been better, you know, offering different pay or a different schedule that would have worked out better with the childcare situation. But I was unable to really find anything that would fit. It was definitely difficult. And I've also been working for this organization for upwards of 9 years. So, you know, I became an important kind of figure in the organization and all the daily operations. So it's difficult to leave this position in particular as well.
Thank you. That's Lisa from Philadelphia. I mean, I think about, Corinne, these back to office mandates that just kind of kicked in. And I want you to kind of rank some of the drivers here that may have pushed women to make this difficult decision. And you heard Lisa talk about it was very hard for her. Return to office mandates. There's also layoffs that have come, childcare prices, culture. Like, what do you think sort of moves the needle the most? Or is it just everything hitting at once?
I think it's so hard to separate those different factors, and it's going to take us more time of analyzing this data in retrospect to see what happened. But I do like that you brought up the layoffs, because there are pieces of this where it's a choice that women are making, and I'll talk a little bit more about that choice. But there's also women where their jobs were displaced. We saw the federal workforce cut. We saw federal funding cut that is funding things like schools, libraries, state and local government programs. A lot of women of color were employed in these industries where we've seen the biggest cuts. And so I think we don't want to overlook the piece that is some women are not choosing to step out. Some women are being pushed out of the labor force. Now, when you talk about the women who are kind of saying this doesn't add up and maybe making that choice, one thing that I want to emphasize with return to office is that it's not just physically being in the office, it's the way that we work in the office. Mm-hmm. So a study that I often cite surprises people a lot, which is that they showed when you offered women a standard 9-to-5 job that they didn't actually prefer the work from home or the flexible hour job. The standard 9-to-5 was fine with them. But when you instead offered them a job where the employer set your hours, and so now it might be 6 a.m., you know, to 2 one day, but then you're closing the next day, they were willing to give up 40% of their pay to avoid that job. So it's not about, you know, oh, we need flexibility or we always need to be at home. It's that we need boundaries, and American jobs don't have those boundaries. And so when people were saying come back to the office, it's not just, you know, hey, we need you here during this structured time. Because I look at the profession of nursing, which is 86% female and one of the fastest growing professions for women. That's in the office, but it's very structured. You know exactly when you're working and when you're off. And I think it's this work sprawl and this idea that the employer gets to demand that you are there in person whenever they want you there in person, that's kind of the hardest for women.
What about men in this conversation, Julie? That one, I think, possibility is that men could do more. So
men could definitely do more.
So why aren't they? Because we heard that the men's like participation in home labor is flat. So what's going on there, Julie?
One thing that was interesting is at the height of the pandemic, we actually did see men step up. I think some things that were going on were that they were seeing just how much kind of formerly invisible labor women were doing and were home also, and so were able to play a role, but it still wasn't quite enough. I think actually younger men are stepping up and doing more. I do think that cultural shifts are changing a little bit, but again, the workforce is not meant for that. And to Corinne's point about workplace sprawl, that is a tough thing. Also, we just saw that men's wages over the last few years have been rising while women's have been stagnating. So we know that women are not making more money for the work they're doing. And so that ends up meaning that it makes more economic sense for a family for the woman to cut back, for the woman to do more at home. And so that's another piece of the puzzle I think that's important to think about.
So it's cultural norms and economic incentives. Is that what you're saying,
exactly,
Julie?
Yes. Exactly.
And by the way, I want to invite you, our listeners at home and elsewhere, to join the conversation. The question of the day, why do you think women and especially mothers are leaving the workforce? Do you find it hard to balance work and family? If so, tell us about it. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop those comments in the chat. Jill on YouTube says, I worked with a few women who quit because it was cheaper for them to stay at home than pay for childcare. Still had to pinch pennies despite saving thousands a month not paying for childcare. I want to bring in another caller. By the way, thanks, Jill, for that comment. I want to bring in another caller. We have Dan from Bristol on the line. Dan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, yes. I'm a dad of two young kids, and I'm also a small business owner. And I think really you're hitting on a lot of important topics, but I think the first reason why women are leaving the workforce is because they don't have access to paid family leave. So right from the start, they are having to leave their job. They're not able to return and make a good income, and without a statewide program in Pennsylvania, they're going to continue to leave the workforce. So hopefully, you know, Governor Shapiro and leaders in Harrisburg will take the lead and pass a paid family leave program for working parents and really the economy overall.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's Dan from Bristol, dad speaking up about the need for paid family leave. I want to talk a little bit about the impact, you know, of some of these gaps, like the fact that you don't have paid family leave, you don't have some of these protections. What are the impacts on a woman who does decide, you know what, I cannot stay, I have to be gone for a few years? Like, what's the impact, Corinne?
Well, I think when you talked about this, like, return to the past, and, you know, the problem with that is that even though in the moment it does help us meet some of those economic needs that are kind of pressing us at the moment and those family needs, in the long term, it leaves women in a tremendously economically insecure position, which was the position that they were in the past. So when you end up in this position where his career gets prioritized and then she's the one who steps out of the labor force, and by the way, we always say childcare compared to the woman's salary, we don't say actually both people need to pay for childcare because both people need childcare in order to work. So when you end up prioritizing, okay, no, she's going to take on this home labor, he's going to, you know, take on this economic labor. Well, what happens if this marriage doesn't last? What happens if he dies, gets injured, gets laid off? There's economic uncertainty for everyone, right? And now she hasn't been investing in her human capital. What she's been investing in is the children's human capital, which is what we call in economics a public good. It's shared in the household. But if that marriage doesn't last, he takes his career with him, right? And she doesn't have that ability to support herself. And so that's the position that I think you know, women were in the past, of really being economically insecure. And so I think it has long-term impacts. I talk about in my research a period called the squeeze, which is what these women are experiencing. It's when our kids are young, we see housework and childcare time skyrocket, and at the same time, we don't have as much time for work, but we're in a period in our life where we still need to make those career investments. They haven't paid off yet, so we don't have money to throw at the problem. Women leave the workforce during the squeeze, but what is a devastating indictment of our policies is that they don't come back after. There's no on-ramp for them to get back into whatever careers they were pursuing once that squeeze abates. And that's what we should be doing if we had more policy support is, okay, you need to take your foot off the gas for a minute or you need to go part-time, but it is possible then to reaccelerate your career. So that's the economic insecurity, is that these temporary decisions have permanent impacts on women's earnings and on women's careers.
How would we create those on-ramps through policy? Like, I feel like I would like to go to these companies and say, look at all this untapped human potential. You have 100%. all these folks trying to get back into the workforce, maybe 3, 4, 5 years. No one's hiring them. Here's your advantage, company. Go ahead and do it. I don't know how the government, though, would play a part in facilitating that. Do you have ideas, Corinne?
Yeah. I mean, you're 100% right that I think that there's a real profit motive actually in it for companies.
The incentive should be there.
There's talent and there's innovation that you're missing out on. And if you're able to retain these workers through the entirety of their productive working life, right, and the squeeze is such a temporary period, right, then you're going to get that payoff forever. And so there's two things. Like, one, I think during that period of the squeeze, I think that firms should work to have work with more boundaries. And so if we're talking shift work, take a page from healthcare and just make the shift work more predictable. Don't let it be that you're opening the retail store in the morning and then you're closing the next day. Let's have a standard, predictable schedule, even if it does mean you have to take some of those unfavorable shifts, but give women a month notice so they know and they can arrange childcare. It means having designated on-call shifts for some of those more intensive jobs, like women who are lawyers or consultants, right? You don't have to be on call all the time. We could have designated on-call shifts. And I think the role that the government has, well, they could actually create some subsidies, both there and the same way when, you know, there's a new trade agreement, it changes the structure of the economy, and then we subsidize retraining workers or trying to resituate them in the labor force. Well, these women who have been investing in something of tremendous economic importance, their children's human capital, they are displaced workers. And we should have the same government subsidies to try to resituate them in the labor force, where you could tell firms, if you hire somebody who has been doing caregiving and has this, therefore, gap in their employment history, you actually get a subsidy on their wages through a payroll reverse tax for the first, you know, year or so.
Yeah. Did you have anything to add over there, Julie? I see you nodding ahead.
Yeah, Corinne has really got all of the ideas that I would say, but I'll just add a few thoughts. One is that 100% flexibility and predictability are really key. And that's something that both the government and employers can do something about. I also just wanted to note that I think the goal should be work-family ease. I think balance implies that we're actually going to have some like magical, like even scale, right? I think ease is the way to think about it. How can we actually do this in a way that just makes our lives feel easier, which is kind of the opposite of how people feel right now as they're trying to afford life as we know it. Another point from before is that there are really long-term consequences to retirement security for women. Moms especially are really struggling with retirement security as a result of not putting that money aside while they're caregiving. And that's also, it's for children, but it's also for older, you know, parents, for spouses, et cetera. And so people are leaving the workforce or taking time out temporarily to do a variety of different caregiving. And it has a really long-term impact on their economics at home and in the future and during their retirement.
And it's not just savings, it's the Social Security credit. So I completely agree with that. It's that, you know, a woman who is, again, economically supporting her family through doing these tremendously important tasks, she's not getting credit for that labor through Social Security. Yeah. And so she's going to be poorer when she's in old age than a man who was working in the market.
And by the way, Linda on YouTube says, has it occurred to the host that women may want to care for their children? Yes, it has occurred to us. And we will talk about that on the later in the show. But, you know, I want to bring in another caller. I just wanted to let Linda know that we have not forgotten about that part. Susan from Marlton is on the line. Susan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I was curious to know whether anyone had data on grandparents' role, because it seems to me that a lot of grandparents were involved in childcare up until recently, but now they are back in the workforce because the economy is so uncertain. So with the loss of the grandparent role in childcare, what impact does that have?
Great question, Susan from Marlton has. And Corinne, I mean, my grandmother had a big hand in raising me. She was like a babysitter, like a lot of times, and a teacher to all of us. How does that weigh in?
The data shows our caller is completely right that they've actually done studies when somebody loses a grandparent as a caregiver. It could be because the grandparent passes away. It could be because they move and they're no longer co-located. Women tend to leave the labor force because of that. And so it absolutely has a huge impact. And I think you're right. Having longer working time for our older adults is then squeezing those young parents more. And then because also we're having kids later in life, you know, sometimes you have those additional caregiving responsibilities for grandparents. So instead of getting the help, you're actually giving the help.
That's the extra squeeze. I wanted to take a moment, though, and ask about Black women in the workforce, because we've seen the headlines sort of floating around 300,000 Black women having lost their jobs in 2025. Can you kind of put that in context? And is that a harbinger for something else to come in our economy, Corinne? And then I'd love to hear from you as well, Julie.
Yeah, I think it's such an important flag because we have seen this disproportionate impact on Black women. And there's actually a new book that's out called The Double Tax that tackles exactly this issue of focusing on how, you know, Black women are taxed twice. They're, you know, they're women, they're, and they're people of color. And so they're having that impact hit them. And we do see in the data that Black unemployment tends to rise before you end up in a more general recession. And so the fact that we're seeing this impact now, it definitely is a warning sign for the economy overall. And I think it's an indication, again, that we shouldn't necessarily just use this lens of the choosing to step outside of the labor market. Black women's labor force participation has traditionally always been very high. Even married Black women's labor force participation was high back when married white women were working a lot less. And I think this is really a matter of, in some cases, being forced out by certain jobs being hardest hit where these women were employed. And so I think it calls on us to reframe. The one YouTube commenter said, like, what if this is an affirmative choice? And for some people it is, right? But there's also definitely this other look at it, which is just like, are people being given the boot from the labor market?
Yeah. And I want to ask you specifically, Julie, I mean, there's been layoffs in sectors that Corinne sort of alluded to. And there's DEI, there's this anti-DEI sentiment. How does that affect women of color? And what does that foreshadow?
Yeah, I think that's definitely an important point. I think we have a workplace and public policies that were built for white men. I mean, that's just the bottom line. And that means that it was not, you know, considered. And I think racism plays a big role here, right? I think that is a huge part of the story. And right now, what we're seeing is attacks on the federal workforce. So it's not even just layoffs. It's like actual attacks to get rid of this federal workforce that does very much involve more Black women than a lot of other sectors. And so I think that is another huge point. Another thing that I've been thinking about is, as this conversation around supporting women to stay home continues, we did have a program that actually supported women to stay home in our welfare system. And there was a huge emphasis on getting rid of it because Black women should be working was really what the underlying thought was. So I just think there's a lot of just frankly racism in the system and a lot of work we can do to make it better.
Yeah.
Well, that is Julie Cashin, Director mm-hmm. of Women's Economic Justice at the Century Foundation. We have to say goodbye to Julie now, but thank you so much, Julie, for your time today on Studio 2. Lots of great insights.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Let me read this comment from Ray in Collegeville, who says, we need to look globally and look at how other cultures deal with motherhood, parenting, and the workforce. We need to think out of the box. And perhaps we can do some of that out of the box thinking on the other side of this break today on Studio 2. We're talking about a big dip in the number of women, especially mothers, in the American workforce. Why do you think mothers are leaving the workforce? Do you find it hard to balance work and family? Tell us about it. Call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're talking about why more and more mothers are leaving their jobs. Record numbers have left this year and erased a lot of the job gains they made during the pandemic. And we're looking at what's causing women to quit. Our question for you, our listeners, is this. Why do you think women, especially mothers, are leaving the workforce? Do you find it hard to balance work and family? If so, tell us about it. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, share this video and then drop your comments in the chat.
We've been talking with Corinne Lowe, a professor of business economics and public policy at the Wharton School. She has a brand new book. It's called Having It All, What Data Tells Us About Women's Lives and Getting the Most Out of Yours. We also now want to welcome journalist Issy Lepowski, who recently wrote about career women taking a, quote, power pause for the New York Times. Issy, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And let me bring in a caller to kick off this third segment. This is Nick from Media, Pennsylvania. Nick, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is I was a Mr. Mom part-time, and my wife and I were both fortunate to be part-time raising our kids. That would be so much easier if healthcare followed everybody. I know I'm widening the scope of what you're talking about here, but especially people in lower income that are working two and three jobs, they won't leave a job or take a job if they can't maintain healthcare. So that's my question.
Thank you, Nick.
That's an important perspective. Thanks, Nick. And that ties me back to something that Ray from Collegeville said before the break, wanting us to look outward, Corinne, look at other societies, other places around the world, what their policies are. What are some ideas that you'd like to steal from elsewhere around the world?
Well, I mean, such a great point, because, you know, if going part-time means you lose your health care, then a lot of people are afraid to go part-time and then be able to maintain their participation in the labor market. In a lot of European countries where health care is not tied to employment, we see women go part-time while their kids are young, and then they're able to re-enter the labor force, right? And so
keep that foot in the door a little
bit.
Yeah,
and so some women might be making the choice to say, look, if I stay part-time, I don't have health care and I don't qualify for Medicaid, so I might as well just leave, not pay for childcare, right? And we've set up a policy bind that doesn't actually incentivize what we want. We want people to be contributing economically in whatever way they're best able, right? And right now, we're not making it possible for them to do that. And it's the same with, you know, paid family leave. When we see paid family leave policies that say you get paid based on what you earned, and so for a second kid, you know, you have to be back in the labor force in order to be eligible for that paid family leave again. Well, we do see women re-entering the labor force, and we see a very different picture than in the U.S.
Very, very interesting. I want to read this comment from Amy from White House Station, who says, I've been a proud stay-at-home mom since 2008. My daughters are now both in high school, and I couldn't be prouder of the choice to raise my children while my husband is the wage earner. I had a career before I had my children and gladly gave it up to raise them. I don't know why anyone ever said women can have it all. And so I want to bring Corinne into the conversation, because I know you've been profiling women who consciously decided to step back. I want to bring Issy into the conversation. I apologize. So Issy, I know you've been profiling women who have consciously decided to take a step back. They've called it this power pause. And I want you to sort of, which is a branded name now. I did not know that. And so I want you to explain what this power pause is and why this group of women may be a little bit different from the women we've been talking about earlier in the show.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. I cannot take credit for the term the power pause. This was coined by an author named Neha Roush. And it really is about women who, to be clear, you know, have achieved a certain amount of career success, privilege, means, and are deciding on their own volition that for whatever reason, you know, in Neha's book, she talks a lot about mothers, but this applies to a lot of women across the board. For whatever reason, they want to shift in a different direction. They may want to be full-time stay-at-home mom. They may want to take on a part-time position. They may want to be their own boss. And so the way in which this differs from what you guys have been talking about, and to be clear, I want to align myself with what Corinne and Julie have been saying about the women for whom this is not a choice. But there is this kind of emerging group of women who are saying, you know, look, we feel like there has been too much of a binary put in front of us. Like, we have been told our whole lives that you can be a career woman or you can be a stay-at-home mom, the sort of barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen that you guys are talking about. And what we're trying to do is sort of redefine ambition. Mm-hmm. I can be ambitious if I leave my, you know, high-profile CMO job at a major Fortune 500 company and decide to start my own consultancy. That can still look like ambition. I can, decide to take this pause while my children are young, and hopefully the experience and growth that I, you know, gain during that period will be respected when I eventually want to re-enter the workforce. That can still be ambition. So it's sort of a reframing of what I think for a long time has been sort of viewed as women are giving up, or they are being pushed out, or something is happening to them. This is women trying to sort of make an affirmative choice for themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of the folks that you talked to for your story, Issy, were there any anecdotes that really stood out that you feel like crystallized this concept?
There were a few. Yeah. So one woman I spoke with, you know, she said she had been working since she was basically legally allowed to. You know, she put herself through college. She had never not been working. She had been raised by a single mom. She had never considered that not working was a possibility. She sidelined personal life for most of her young life and sort of climbed the corporate ladder, eventually had a child at 40. And she goes back to work and she, you know, people are telling her she had parental leave, she had a partner, she had support, she had a lot of the sort of infrastructure that a lot of women in this country do not. And people were saying, oh, you know, get a nanny, get two nannies. And what she said that really stuck with me was, I don't want a nanny, I want my moments. And I think the truth is that for some women, there is no work-life balance flexibility that is going to afford you all of that time with your child. And if that is what you want, these women are saying, you know, we should not necessarily feel the pressure to not go out and grab that, particularly when we have, you know, we have had the success, right? We celebrate the other markers of success. People buy a yacht or people do whatever, but these women are trying to embrace a period of their lives as that marker of success. And then there were other women, you know, who do not have children at home and had, you know, again, climbed the corporate ladder and felt like, I do not want to continue to do that. I want to be my own boss. So they have gone out and started their own firms that are much smaller and nobody's ever heard of them, but they have full control of their time and it's the happiest they've ever been. All of these women, though, I will say, you know, were very, very cognizant of how tricky this is, right? Like, we are talking about a time when there is a lot of pressure, as we've discussed, for women to leave the workforce. And what does it mean if I'm no longer at the table for setting an example for the next generation of women? This was not often an easy decision for these women to make, even if it was their decision.
Yeah, and I want to read this comment from Tisha, who says, we have to do too much. It's not worth having a 9-to-5 if you have to neglect your kids for it. Next thing you know, they become losers, all in the name of giving them all they wanted. Being home and doing homework and spending time with them is a privilege and a sacrifice. So I want to talk about this balance that a lot of women feel, like this tension, this pull, because on one hand, you know, Issy, you talked about how women, they work really hard, they got these degrees, right? They got this big career. And then you wait all these years and you finally have your child. And it's like, there is grief, you know, that comes with making these decisions, because your identity is sort of tied up in the job in a lot of ways. But then your identity is also tied up in being a mom. Can you talk about that tension and how these moms who decide to make this power move, how they work through that, Issy?
Every one of these women talked about exactly that dynamic, the grief that you feel when you lose your title, right? And Neha Roush, you know, writes in her book that she kind of felt naked. People ask what you do and you say, oh, I'm a stay-at-home mom in her case, and they kind of, their eyes glaze over and they move on to the next. But what a lot of them talked about was the fact that while this is an ongoing process, in some ways it could be more empowering, that they were no longer tying their identity to a third party from which they could be laid off or what have you, but now stepping into their own identity as mom or working under their own name for their own company. So I would say for all of them, it was a real struggle, and probably remains so. It is a little unmooring to no longer be able to say, I am of this, or I work for this place. And there are a lot of assumptions made, right, about women who are not working, that they are, you know, aligning themselves with these traditional family values as
trad wise. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And that was not the case for a lot of these women. And to answer our caller or commenter's comment, you know, these women were also saying, this was a choice I made for me. It is not meant to say that, you know, if my child goes to daycare or my child has a nanny, they will be worse off. Like, like mom is best, right? That is, I think, a pressure that is put on moms who want to be working or need to be working. And these women are not laying that at their feet. They are saying, I did this because I want to, not because I think nobody else can care for my kid.
Yeah. Let me bring in a caller as we get toward the end of the hour. Michelle is calling from the main line, and I think has a story to tell us. Michelle, you're on Studio 2. Tell us your experience.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I took a power pause in my late 40s, and I just spent time with, I had twins late in life. They were 5 years old. And then subsequently my husband left later that same year. And I wanted the callers to be aware of, you know, what happens when the courts find out that you were a high wage earner is they assign you an earning capacity and basically tell you, go back to work. And so that is a huge risk that I personally was unaware of. And so I wasn't able to have that time with my kids. I was sent right back to the workforce. And what happens to women, and I think it can be very surprising, is the on-ramp is very difficult to find. So even though you had this career and you, you know, you think it's going to be there for you, even after just a year or two out of the workforce, it can be very difficult to find another job, especially at the level that you were previously employed. And for me, it was an incredibly difficult road to hoe.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you for sharing
that
with us.
That was a powerful testimony.
Corinne, you were listening to that, and I think you had some reaction. What were your thoughts about Michelle's story?
Yeah, I mean, that references back to what I talked about, you know, economic security for women. And the reality is that what we see is it is the most economically secure women who are able to make this choice to invest in their children's human capital. And I loved that Issy talked about, you know, buying a yacht, because we call it actually in economics a luxury good, that raising our own children is a luxury good, because when women are higher earning, we see them spend more time with their kids, not less. And that's kind of surprising because their wage is higher, their opportunity cost is higher, but it's because they have the economic security to do it. And so the caller was warning us that, like, that economic security can be temporary, that framework that you're doing that within, right? The marriage where, you know, one person can earn in the market and to support that investment in kids, that can be temporary.
Yeah, that's so interesting, by the way. Maura from Ridley Park says, I've had to take an independent contractor position in order to have flexibility as a single mom to be able to take care of my child. But because I'm independent, I've lost my health care, 401k, and any benefits a normal 9-to-5 employee makes. So this, for a lot of women, this is a really tough decision, and it is a sacrifice, Corinne.
And that just shows you where policy could do so much better, because if we acknowledge that, you know, women caring for their own children is also a form of economic production, that it is, again, investments in the human capital of the next generation. What could be more important than that? Then society should be set up to support that. And so if part-time roles are what allow women to both, you know, earn something in the market and take care of their children, how do we create the infrastructure where you are in that mode? It doesn't have to be, you know, the women in Issy's story, I think, did acknowledge their privilege. It shouldn't have to be the women who, you know, whose husbands are working at Goldman Sachs, who are the ones who are able to do this. We should all have the right to be able to invest in our children. And all it would take would be healthcare, would be a social safety net, right? Would be some of those things that make it possible.
Affordable child care.
Exactly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. We do have to wrap it up, but I want to thank both of our guests, Corinne Lowe, Wharton Professor of Business Economics and Public Policy, and the author of a new book called Having It All, What Data Tells Us About Women's Lives and Getting the Most Out of Yours. Corinne, thank you so much for your insights this hour.
Thanks for having me.
And also a big thank you to Issy Lepowski, a New York Times contributor who recently wrote about this idea of a power pause. Issy, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. All right.
Yes.
So and now.
Yes, it is time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Let's hit it.
Redesigning women, running the world while we're cleaning up the kitchen, making bang, shaking hands, driving 80, trying to get home just to feed the baby, skipping the bread.
Ooh, I love that song.
Yes.
It's called Redesigning Women by the High Women. From 2019, that's a super group, country super group. You know
wow.
about them, Cherry?
I have not great heard about group. Them, but I like it.
Brandi Carlile, Natalie Hemby, Maren Morris, and Amanda Shires.
I know those names. And thank you to Emily from Westchester for choosing that song and for being our DJ of the day. And by the way, before we allow this to roll out, I want to say thank you to our producers, Zebby Builder, Andreas Coast, Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks, and Tina Calique, engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY, I'm Cherry Gray.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Eric, we will talk to you next week. Play us out, Al.
Making bank, shaking hands, driving 80, trying to get home just to feed the baby. Bread for the butter, changing our minds.